Dargotha Hour.
Dargotha.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Dargotha. Okay, good. All right, got
Or
that one out of the way
Dargoth.
pretty quickly. So, I don't know, do you want to start with the biggest news since the last podcast?
What's the biggest news since the last podcast?
Oh,
Oh,
sleep.
yeah.
Yes,
No, yeah.
Sleepy Joe's
Go
out
on.
of it.
Sleepy Joe.
Yeah.
He's out of it.
It got to a point where it did actually kind of start feeling a bit like elder abuse. Just like getting him
But
out there.
it was, I agree, because for the longest time we found it very funny, right? You post these clips of Biden saying, America could be summed up in one word, America got name was in America. Like, it's fucking hilarious. It did feel a little bit abusive towards the end, but then it was self-inflicted abuse. Like, he's the one insisting that he be put in this position.
Yeah, but that's kind of like the old person that's insistent on escaping from the home, right? Like,
But
sometimes it's.
he's putting himself forward to be the leader of the free world, as they like saying. It's a different situation, if you just escaped from the old person's home because you really wanted to go to the aquarium or something, you'd be like, yeah, fair enough. Like, power to you. But no, he's trying to lead the most powerful fucking country in the
Well, I hope he has a nice retirement. Maybe he can work on his golf game. I don't believe for a second he's got a, was it a handicap of 8?
That was that bit of the fucking. It just, I you know the it's a trite joke, but when they turn the Hadron Collider on, that's like your theory of like when we went into the wrong universe, right? And it just, that was one of those moments where this is a fucking presidential debate, and the only thing they've got enthused about is arguing about who's better at golf.
Yeah. And oh, there was that bit where Biden got like he had a little scripted bit where he got angry. But it was like but it was like it looked so much like he was trying to remember it. Like he was that was a scripted bit. You got to get angry here, Mr. President, and
I would love it if you read that bit aloud.
yeah. Oh, and of course there's all those bits where he goes he da, 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 he does his speech and he goes long pause. Hold for applause, all that kind of stuff. When he like when he reads out the directions on the teleprompter, which, to be fair, I have been a teleprompter operator on occasion, and there are so many like easy things to, that can go wrong with that. Like it's
Oh,
such.
yeah, no, of course, yeah.
I remember when Trump got lambasted because he said Nambia instead of Namibia on a teleprompter. Oh,
Sorry.
you played a bit of Half-Life there in the
I actually accidentally launched Left 4 Dead 2. That was
Oh,
entirely
do,
accidental. I'm not
I
going to be talking about the two. Sorry, go on, yeah.
I com you I completely what was I saying?
Teleprompter, there's so
Oh
many things that
yeah.
can go
There's
wrong.
so many things that can go wrong because like the person on the other side of the teleprompter is adjusting the speed in real time as it's going up. So
Oh.
if they're reading faster or slower or pausing it, so you've always got to have someone there. And when and you're reading words that are moving,
Yeah.
so and if you write down Namibia on a keyboard, and just like glance at it for a second and look away, it will look like Nambia. I always feel like I did. I love it.
Yeah, no, I'm not like it's not, the point of this isn't that like every time somebody makes a verbal fuck up, it's funny. Like, verbal fuck ups are in themselves kind of amusing
Oh,
amongst,
amazing,
when
yeah.
somebody says the wrong word in a conversation. I think it's a particularly English thing as well. We love taking the piss out of that.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's more, because I mean, if I were in that presidential debate, like if I got quantum leaped into it and it was me having to do it, like, I would fuck up more than Biden, I'm sure. I
Yeah.
would, I, you know, conversational dead ends and verbal, fuck up
Yeah.
more than Biden. But it's not my job. It's his job. Like, a major portion of his job is communication, speaking clearly, expressing ideas clearly to people. Like, that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
And it's not just that he made the odd, and it kind of annoys me that everybody's fixing on the debate. The blue no matter who, Biden no matter what kind of people.
Yeah.
It's saying, what, one bad debate, everybody's being so, like, it wasn't one, like, the
No,
debate was
yeah.
sort of symbolic of, like, a he was he's not that much worse than he was the first time. And, you know, we were taking the piss out of him the first time. Like, it's there's been a continual deterioration, but he's been unfit for the longest time.
Yeah, but this was that particular debate, it was a crystallization of the deterioration, right? Like, it was like,
yeah,
he had fumbles like that, but like, did he, I can't remember a time when, and also with the debate, you're supposed to like be super prepared for it. And like, when he, you know, when he trails off like the way he did, that was indicative of like, he's got to do the job for 4 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, even,
I think it was an event that made it plain to everybody that, but it wasn't the debate itself is my point. They were making out like, you know, one bad debate before, and that's not the point. No. It was
Obama's first debate was quite bad, as I understand it, but he managed to turn that around.
His favorite tick of mine though was when he got lost in a sentence or forgot what he was saying, and then he'd just go, "Come on, man! Come on, Jack!"
I like the time where there was someone who was at one of his events, and he was talking about something like how the DNC maybe treated Bernie Sanders or something, and then and then Joe Biden just went up to him and goes, "Listen here, fat." I was like,
yeah, that was a town hall thing, wasn't it?
The town hall thing. It's like, that was almost like, I don't know what was he like, because that's not really an insult. That's just like a, you're just expressing a characteristic.
Yeah. I think he reverted to, did you ever hear him telling that story about when he was a lifeguard at a pool in, I don't know, like the 40s or 50s in like a black neighborhood, and he told the story of like these black gangs, and they would put like razor blades in water butts so that they got rusty, you know, so if you cut somebody, you got his back. He just went off with, and it involved, you know, people putting palm oil in their hair, and it sounded like the most old man story.
Yeah.
And the point of the story was supposed to be like how he, you know, he's great with black people.
That kind of reminds me of a Ben Carson thing. He always, he had a sort of a similar story, which I believe actually turned out to be fake, but I'm not.
Well, Biden did that. I assume you know about this. I can't remember what it was. This was years ago when he was running for something, Senate or something, and he literally copied an anecdote that Neil Kinnock gave about his early life.
Oh wow.
Yeah, he literally ripped off a Neil Kinnock anecdote and presented it as if this was his life story, and he got caught out for it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was something Kinnock had said in Parliament, I thought, or in some campaign or something, and he literally, it wasn't like, you know, they had similar experiences. He literally ripped it off, like, word for word, basically.
So, because it seems to me that one of the distinctions between American politics and British politics is that American politics is like, they seem to love this like personalized like narrative of you know the.
Yeah, well, they would. I think they try. Some of the leaders tried to do that in our debate.
Mm. The son of a toolmaker.
I think Starmer's whole thing, like my dad. Yeah, son of a toolmaker. But like a lot of them were doing. You know, I connect with this issue because my family has gone through it, and I don't want that.
Mm.
I think in America, I think the president is a somewhat fictional position. I think you accept a degree of fictionalization, and for them to say things like, you know, you kind of see it in the West Wing, right? You have the speech writers writing speeches for the president and including anecdotes that the speech writers are just making up or have heard somewhere, and then the president presents this anecdote as if it's something that happened to them, and nobody's fooled by that. It's just this acceptance that the president is sort of a hyperial figure.
Yeah,
like almost like an amalgamation of, you know, what the ideas that we want to pour into the figurehead of our nation, and I sort of accept that to an extent. Like, yeah, that's fine.
Well, that's how like human minds seem to internalize stuff. I mean, that's why, like, with a lot of stories in the Bible, like the onus isn't necessarily on whether or not they're literally true or not. It's the way that the story,
that allegory.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like, you know, Robin Hood and King Arthur, you know, not many. I mean, they may have been historical figures to some extent, but, you know, they're amalgamations at this point. They represent our ideas about ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It seems to be, you know, it's just the human mind works in a narrative way, right?
Mm. But I don't think British political figures have ever really, not to the same extent, been that. And I find it uncomfortable when they try to be that, because we're not. That's not how our system works. It's not like snobbish, like that's too good, or we're not good. We're too good for that. I don't mean that. I think it's just our parliamentary system is very different from a presidential system.
Yeah, and I don't think we're expected to like our leaders. We're just
not in the same way. No, you know that whole like in American politics is very important. You know, the average person would go for a beer with this person.
Mm.
Like, who gives a shit?
Exactly.
I don't think
yeah.
we have that. Like, who would have gone for a beer with Margaret Thatcher? Incredibly popular, but nobody would have wanted to hang out with her.
Exactly. I don't think anyone wants to hang out with Keith Starmer, but like,
oh god, can you imagine?
So tell me again about what your father did for a living.
Oh god,
I love the bit. I love the bit in the one-on-one interviews that he did, and I can't remember who it was. Quite well known, I think, BBC journalist, and she asked him, can you tell us a little bit about your personality? And his response was, I dedicated all my life to public service. It's like,
hanging out with Keith, it'd be like, you get home in the evenings, right, time for some fun. And he gets out, like, gets his spreadsheets out.
Yeah, his spreadsheets, or his Times crossword, or, yeah, it's...
I thought Times crossword, but that was like, no, that's far too exciting.
Far too exciting for him, yeah, so
it's a bit John Major-ish.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Less, but the problem with John Major, I think John Major, by when I say things like this, obviously the context is in, you know, he's a Tory prime minister. But in that context, I kind of like John Major, honestly. But the problem with John Major was that he was a figure of failure, because he was you know, he was at the wrong time to, you know, blah blah blah.
Yeah,
but he did a lot for the Northern Irish peace program. Anyway, I think Starmer's got a lot of the John Major about him, but he's like surrounded by success rather than failure is the difference.
Yeah, I think John Major would actually be all right to go with a drink with. He wouldn't be the most exciting guy, but
no, I think he'd be fun. Yeah, yeah, he seemed very genuine.
Yeah, yeah, and I
and of course, Bitten Image being a satire program in the UK in the 80s with puppets, and they characterized him as a human that was entirely grey.
Yeah.
And he would go home at night and eat a bowl of grey peas. That's how they characterized him.
Oh my god. Yeah, I guess so. So in America they've got Kamala Harris, VP by the looks of it. She seems to be the
I hope not. I think there's like a 0.00, you know, blah blah blah, 1% chance that they actually have a contested convention. I would love to see that. There's not been a contested convention in America since 1952.
I can't imagine
a broken convention, as they call it. I can't imagine it happening, but I would love for them, for somebody. I mean, it could, you know, this is literally never going to happen. I'm not implying that I think this is a possibility, but you know, like Bernie gets nominated from the floor and actually, you know, like some cinematic thing happens. I would love that.
Yeah, I think.
But you know, more than likely, it's Kamala. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, large. The thing that sort of makes it seemingly obvious is that all of the possible competitors have endorsed Kamala, and I feel that was
clearly. I mean, that's not. That was. Like somebody's made that happen. That hasn't just organically happened, right?
I would imagine it's someone in the Biden campaign, maybe someone like Obama. They say that he's doing a lot behind the scenes to get Biden to stand aside.
Well, one thing I've heard is that there's what's happening right now, and the reason that Obama hasn't endorsed Kamala Harris is that there's a sort of factional infight between the Obama faction and the Clinton faction.
All right,
and I don't know whether that's true, but it's certainly plausible. Yeah. Basically, Obama, like what this person I was reading was suggesting is that Obama's setting himself up to be like the grandee of the Democratic Party. He thinks Kamala's going to lose. He sort of tricked the Clintons into supporting Kamala, so they're attached to a loser, and then he inherits like the most powerful position within the DNC and gets to rebuild it. Which don't no idea whether that's true or not, but it's plausible.
Is it plausible? They don't usually think that far ahead, do they?
I think Obama's a bit of a, and he's very boring as well. But he's a planner.
There were a lot of times during his presidency where he could have done things but felt like he decided not to because he sort of anticipated failure. And he was...
Go on, sir.
And he was locked up for a lot of his time. And... But there were like performative things that he could have done as president that could have energized people. And I think he failed to do that. So like sometimes it's, you know, with politics, it's not always a case of shooting to win, but sometimes it's a case of making enough noise that it then puts tangential pressure on other parts of the system, other people, raises public awareness.
I think this is captured actually, if you rewatch The West Wing, this is almost like, in retrospect, what it's about. But I think Democrats are unwilling to, they're always like, we could, you know, technically on paper, we have the levers to do this thing, but we can't afford it in terms of political capital.
Mm.
Whereas Republicans will get in control and they're like, we're going to pull the levers that we, you know, we always implied and said, you know, like the Roe v. Wade thing, repealing Roe v. Wade. I mean, that happened under a Democrat, but they will just, and they're like, fuck the political capital. This is what we're here to do.
Yeah.
I wish the Democrats would do that. And I don't think Obama particularly wanted to change much. I don't think he was a particularly progressive president, but I do wish that when they, Biden certainly could have with the student loan, he could have, there were mechanisms whereby he could have, which he said he would do. It was one of his campaign promises in the first time he was elected.
Isn't there a fair amount of student loan debt forgiveness?
No. No, because he did it in the way that was most susceptible to being challenged.
Oh,
I forget the details, but there was a way for him to do it. Yeah, anyway, yeah. Essentially, he could have done it, but it's like, well, yeah, it's political capital, blah blah blah. We can't afford it, and it's like, no, will you? Yeah, I mean, I don't think he actually wanted to do it. I think that's why he did it that way. But yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, maybe I don't know. Like the trouble is, you see the Democrats being bad at politics time and time again. And I know that there are a lot of theories as to suggest the tactical fumble and how that links in.
Well, I don't think.
And how that links in with their donors, because, Republicans can sort of sell themselves out in a way that Democrats can't. Democrats still have to have the facade of being vaguely left.
I think it's in the vested interests of the Democrats to not get anything done, because then they can keep fundraising on that issue. If they, you know, which they could have done initially, once and for all, you know, make abortion legal forever, then they lose that. They lose every time, you know, a Republican governor does something crazy, they lose that ability to fundraise over it. So I think it's because it's a political party, but it's also a business, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a fundraising thing that, you know, creates a great living for a huge number of people. And I think that aspect of it, they are almost hardwired for failure because that's how they make more money.
Yeah, but I think most political discussions among anyone with more than a couple of brain cells, it tends to come back to that issue of money in politics, right? Like it seems to be almost at this point the bottleneck. And if you can't, like, it seems like there's this you know, you've got the powers that be, the donors, the sort of, basically you've got the donor class. And they, it's like the Dems can't really sort of get rid of them, otherwise they're just disarming themselves. But at the same time, they can't bring in any vaguely like left-wing policies because it will affect the donor class. And there's no shortage of corporations even donating to both the Democrats and the Republicans, because then they can hold the withdrawal of that money over them. I think Google, I remember seeing Google put a lot of money on both.
Oh, no, yeah, I think, if anything, I think, like, the majority of corporations donate to both, or they donate to whichever side they think is going to win, at least, if not donating to both. But I don't think just taking donations out of campaign financing would, because essentially, we have very hard limits on that over here. Like, you cannot actually donate very much to, blah, blah, blah. And we're not really, in terms of being beholden to capital, we're not really any better off here. Because it's not just about the direct donations. It's about lobbying. You know, the corporations can fund, you know, endless expert lobbyists.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, the revolving door between politics and industry, politics and media, you know, politics and lobbying.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many ways that money can influence politics, even without direct campaign financing. I think that in itself, I don't think solve problems.
It doesn't, but it seems like the other problems in America in particular can't be solved until you stop that one problem, because also with campaign finance reform, it's one of the most popular bipartisan issues. So
it would certainly be a good step for sure. Yeah, yeah.
But it's not like an issue. I can't imagine many people making, like, I don't think many people are going to flip between Republican or Democrat based on campaign finance reform, despite the fact that something like 70% of all voting Americans are on the same page with it.
Yeah. Oh, I think that should go hand in hand with because, like, we've just had an election, right? It's like, mm-hmm. almost like, you know, while the Americans have been having their election, we could, you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Ours took 7 weeks. The American election, I think technically it takes about a year, but if you count from when they start campaigning in New Hampshire and Iowa,
mm-hmm.
it's more like a year and a half. It's like it's 18 months, right?
Yeah.
To 2 years.
I mean, it. Yeah.
Which is absurd. That is an absurd, and you know that's part of why you need so much money. You need to keep running those TV ads for 2 fucking years, you know, and it's not just TV ads anymore, but you know what I mean? Like, that's part of why you need so much money. It's also, you know, for a sitting president, having to campaign for essentially 18 months is a huge amount of time out of them doing what they're supposed to be doing, you know, yeah,
and not just president, governors, senators, all the way down a ticket.
Yeah.
I saw it broken down for me. It's like they're spending something like 4 hours a day fundraising or something crazy like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like, my God, and that's a hot, to be honest, I wouldn't even like to do that. Like, it's just, that's
no,
just.
No. If you're, I mean, we're idealizing, but if you have the civic responsibility gene and you're interested in, you know, public service, mm. and then you get into, you know, the Senate or whatever, and you've got to spend most of your time just fundraising and, like, awful.
Yeah. I wonder if, like, that could potentially lessen with social media. Like, older politicians are obviously notoriously bad at social media, with some exceptions. But, you know, the sort of the AOC generation, do you think that they could sort of circumnavigate that a little bit?
Well, I think part of the reason why Bernie and, to a lesser extent, Trump are despised by, you know, the political and media class is that they prove that you don't need the big donors. Like, Bernie was funded by, you know, overwhelmingly, like, small donations from normal people, right? And that's also, to a large extent, true of Trump. He gets a lot of donations, you know, small donations from normal people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the donor class do not want that because they do not want to lose, you know, that influence.
Mm. Although that being said, I think the media class might not necessarily, like, I know that obviously media benefit hugely from not only the views that the elections bring in, but also the advertising. And but with Trump, and I think maybe you can make this argument for Bernie, is that they are interesting enough characters that they're like, they'll bring in lots of views for the media. Like, the media, like, as much as they, you know, outrage about Trump,
I think they enjoy, you know, that's why they give these, and, you know, Farage over here, that's why they get so much airtime, is because, honestly, just people find them fun to watch.
Yeah.
So they get views. But I think the pertinent thing here is that, you know, the media organizations are owned by the billionaires who are members of the donor class. That's the problem there. That's why that can only go so far.
Yeah. But it does sort of, in a way, seem that they're in a win-win scenario.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So, yeah.
And also, Trump does get some fairly, like, big money donors, right? Like, AIPAC is funneling untold amounts of cash with him. I was quite amused, actually, that Trump was saying in one of his speeches that Elon Musk's PAC is giving him $45 million a month. And then, like, in an interview, Elon Musk sort of kind of rode that back a little bit. It was like, well, oh, man. Those two, right? Those two together, Elon Musk and Donald Trump, they know that if they can work together, they're kind of unstoppable. But at the same time, they hate each other because they're such, like, egomaniacs. So there's this.
Yep. And different, very different kinds of assholes. As well,
very different kinds of assholes. It's
politically perhaps on the same page in a lot of ways, but or at least, I don't think Trump has politics, but in terms of how he's positioning himself,
yeah, it's Yeah, because I mean, Elon Musk, of course, was famously in Trump's cabinet, which, so, like, Elon Musk keeps talking about, well, he spoke a long time for about how he was like, oh, not Democrats, not Republicans, I'm like a swing voter or something. You were in the Trump administration for a spell. Like, you can only be so partisan if you're working in the
Well,
White
I mean, the
House.
part of that is just that, American, well, the two big parties in America, they're not political parties in the sense that we think about them in Europe or really, the rest of the inverted commas democratic world, right? They're not membership parties. Neither of them.
No, do you register with the Electoral Commission or something? Like, I they don't even.
No, I think when you insert it, I think this varies state to state, but and this is bizarre to me. When you register to vote, you register to vote as either a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, which is, I don't know why that, I don't know what, well, I don't know the purpose of that. I don't really understand that at all. And I know its function is that, again, this varies state to state, but in certain states, if you want to take part in the Republican primaries, you have to be registered as a Republican voter, right?
Yeah, is it? Oh, sorry, I knocked the mic there. Is it part of this like faux idea of the primaries being part of the official process? Because of course, in what is fundamentally a two-party system, you have to like you have two choices. But if you only literally have two pre-selected choices, then that's a pretty sorry excuse for democracy. So is the illusion there that you can choose who you want for primary and then?
That sounds right. Yeah, that sounds
But at the
right.
same time, Democrats were also challenged on, I think it was like Biden skipping a lot of the primary process in his re-election. And I think their legal argument for that was, we're the DNC, we can do what we like, we're a private party. So I think it does seem like it's like, I don't know, they're flexible on the idea. When they want to like lock out third parties, it's like, it's okay, we have a primary, anyone can stand in our primary or that kind of thing. But
It's like,
also,
oh, they're doing well though. Our choice is not doing so well. So that's the end of the primary. Sorry.
and that seems to be how American politics works. It's like basically you just make the argument at the time, and like a lot of like
Which is an
Supreme.
incredibly, that's an incredibly conservative influence on politics, right? Because the people who are in control of the DNC or the RNC are, former presidents, former staffers, former luminaries in Republican and, failed presidential candidates and stuff like that. So it's always like the old folk of the party make choosing who is the next leader. But in both parties, I mean, they failed with Trump because they didn't shut it down quick enough. But
Well,
generally speaking,
Trump was a bizarre phenomena, really. And I think he ended.
I think that what that demonstrates actually is I think that the Republican Party in that sense is a bit more democratic than the Democrats.
Which always I always get thinking about is whether or not a left-wing takeover of the Republican Party is actually
More
possible.
plausible.
Yeah, like obviously you wouldn't use a democratic-based left-wing policy. You would tailor it for the rhetoric of the Republicans,
I mean, you could
but.
certainly see, this is the kind of left-wing stuff that's doing well in a lot of places in Europe. Is you could see like a socially conservative, economically left-wing faction doing well,
And
and which you're actually starting, you're starting to see with some Republicans. You're starting to see like in odd places they're supporting what would usually be considered quite left-wing economic.
Well, there's and also there are like there are you can sort of wrap things up in capitalist rhetoric. There was a climate change panel. It was hosted by Bernie Sanders, but someone on the panel was a Republican mayor of a city. I forget which city it was. And they expanded renewable energy. Like just they were like it was like the second most good city for renewable energy or something like that in the whole America. And it had a Republican mayor who sort of spearheaded the process. So.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's one of the sort of the contradictions or ironies, within, well, it's one of the demonstrations why capitalism is kind of at this point a failing system, in that going very green would be incredibly good for capitalism. You got these new industries, these new areas of innovation. It would be great, stimulating jobs, stimulating.
you could have the West as, you know, a manufacturing center again. Yeah. The countries that, you know, leading this stuff would do amazingly well economically, but it's a challenge to the vested interests of oil. That's the, you know, fundamentally what it comes down to.
Yeah.
I think everybody knows that it would be good for capitalism. You know, it's not even capitalism, you know, inherently being against these things. It's the vested interest within capitalism being against these things.
Yeah, I kind of think about that with universal basic income. Is the universal basic income it is just ongoing economic stimulus, but but it's like, so you give, you know, you give everyone 1,000 quid a month, let's say, and you know, the people spend it on clothes, food, bills, grocery, you know, like most people are probably not going to be spending it on holidays, if we're honest, right? They're going to be spending it on just generally materially improving their lives, and all of that funnels up either back to the government or upwards, right? Like it does, you know, like,
well, it goes to the businesses you spend the money with. It's like you say, it's a permanent fiscal stimulus. Yeah,
but the trouble is, of course, is that people get to decide where they spend their money then. So presumably companies would prefer the economic stimulus just to bypass the customer and go straight to them, right?
No, honestly, I think if you just put it to businesses, you know, do you want this to happen? I think they say yes. I think what it is it's a step towards socialism. I think that's what they're terrified of. It's a step towards disconnecting people's ability to live from the necessity of wage work, essentially. I think that's what upsets them about it. Same as with working from home.
Yeah.
Working from home is better for businesses. It would lower their costs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what they're afraid of is losing control.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also tied into, you know, the businesses that own businesses also own the places that businesses rent to, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's part of it too. They're scared of diminishing their assets, but I think it's more the other thing.
Yeah. Well, the property, property in London, of course, is top commodity, right? So if everyone starts working from home, that basically devalues a lot of property in London, doesn't it?
Well, only to an extent, though, because, you know, a lot of the kind of properties that people buy in London, they're sitting empty anyway. They're buying them as an asset, that, you know, whose price just inflates over time. They don't really care. You know, if you're getting an income from it through rent, that's a bonus, but that's not the major reason why you're buying, which is why, you know, they will own all these empty properties. They're just going up. They're just going up in value all the time, and it's part of why they don't want to buy new houses, because, you know, the more you build, that's a deflationary pressure. There'd still be inflation, but it less of it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's why you get a lot of conservatives being opposed to new house building, which is sort of contrary to Thatcher, right? Where Thatcher's kind of idea was, people get more conservative when they own a home, so make everyone own their own home, let them buy their council houses, let, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I think that's proven out. I think, you know, because so many people rent now, and rent is, you know, well, rent is what it is.
Yeah.
That's pushed a lot of people towards, you know, economically left positions.
Yeah,
you know, she wasn't wrong.
There's that chart that shows that about halfway through Gen X, people stopped getting left wing as they got older.
Which
correlates very smoothly with the rate the rate at which people own property, and also how, like, people are owning their own homes later in life, if at all, and I think like Thatcher basically cracked the code, and she ensured conservative popularity for basically up until Liz Truss or something like that, you know.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a political tradition that goes all the way back to, you know, Jefferson. Just it's liberalism, really. It's just, you know, a class of property owning people who are inherently invested in you know, the liberal economy.
Yeah,
which it potentially is workable. You know, if you could get the problem is that a system like that, you can't have everybody being a property owner. You need an underclass. You need an exploited workforce. That's why that can't sort of lead to a kind of situation.
Yeah, like it sort of only goes so far, but but I don't know, maybe.
I was just gonna say, back to the fundamental, do you think, so assuming Kamala's the pick, and putting whoever she chooses as a running mate aside, do you think the Democrats' chances of winning this election have now improved?
Yes, and more than I initially thought.
I think
My suspicion was they would have lost with Biden, they would have lost with Harris. They probably would have just been destined to lose. But watching like a lot of people get energized behind Kamala, watching her grassroots fundraising basically go through the roof, and so many groups sort of backing her very, what feels like authentically, enthusiastically, I think there's a chance. I was watching a political live stream where someone was breaking down the Electoral College votes on what's it, 270 or whatever it's called. And they sort of worked out that actually, it's if the winds blow in the right direction, it's not impossible. And combine that with the fact that people have already stopped talking about Trump's assassination attempt, or not the assassination attempt on Trump. Like, that news seems to have blown over like really quickly.
That's really shocking, isn't it? Yeah, I've heard several people talk about that. Like, it's, you know, it's, what is it, a week or two later, and we've kind of, like, I've almost forgotten about it.
Yeah.
I don't think in, like, in the 90s, 80s, 90s, even into the early 2000s, I don't think that would have gone away so quickly as a... It seems so unimportant at the time. Do you know what I mean?
It was... Yeah. Well, it missed. I mean, it's more important to the guy that got the, hit the bullet, to be honest. You know, that's the...
No, of course. Yeah.
So,
That was weird. But I think, I don't know. So there's a few things to sort of offer as context for this.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, as it stands in the national polls, the Democrats are behind by a few points, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order to win an election, the Democrats, if it's 50-50, then the Republicans win.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of how
electoral college,
how the electoral college, you know, the way the votes are distributed. I mean, I think a lot of libs sort of blame that on gerrymandering. I think it's less gerrymandering and it's more where, you know, the Democrats get an excess of votes in California where they don't need them, and New York where they don't need them, and not enough in, you know, Iowa where they do need them.
Yeah, there was a massive gerrymandering operation in Florida to basically turn it red.
Oh no, for sure. No, there is gerrymandering. I'm not saying there isn't gerrymandering, but the thing that is important for me is gerrymandering is a democratic process. It's Republican governors and Republican elected officials who do the gerrymandering. They are elected knowing that this is going to happen, so you kind of can't really say that that's like a rigging of the system when it's what people have voted for. And also, I think it's far less important than just like certain states get more Democrat votes and certain states get more Republican votes. But to win, the Democrats need like 3-5 percentage points over the Republicans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the ground to make up is bigger than it looks. I don't think it looks good for the Democrats. I'm not sure how much this enthusiasm will last. I'm not sure how much people will continue. I mean, because Biden just, people were unenthused anyway.
Yeah.
There's not much exciting policy. They're unenthused anyway. Then Biden's, you know, obvious unfitness for the job, like really turned people off. So I think you're going to get some of that back, but you know, the policy is still unenthusing. Kamala's to the right of Biden, I would say. And there was a third thing that I forget. Like, I still think it's an uphill battle, but I think it's less than I thought it would be a week ago, if you know what I mean.
So I don't know the minutiae of...
Sorry, Gaza was the third thing. If they're thinking that young people are going to turn out in droves, I don't. Not with their position on Gaza. But yeah, sorry.
Well, okay. I don't know the minutiae of Kamala's policy, but I have heard people say that it's more left than like you might think. So I'm hoping that might sort of manifest itself. I remember in the primaries that she was relatively outspoken in favor of Medicare for all, or at least a universal healthcare system. So
actual, not rhetorical stuff that's easy for, because they're all Democrat. Any Democrat running is in favor of Medicare for all.
Mm-hmm.
Or they, you know, they will at some point say they are, but they've got no intention of actually doing it. They've got no plan for doing it. You know, they know it's not going to happen, which is why they can say it.
I think she might be better on Gaza.
Again, is it because okay? So Keith is better than the Tories on Gaza, right? He said in Parliament that he wants a ceasefire and blah, blah, blah. But it's all, yeah, it's purely rhetorical. He's not doing anything. He's not changing anything. It's entirely rhetorical. And I know I'm sort of nitpicking here, but but I think, especially with the Democrats and with the Labour Party, I think you've got to separate what they say they want to do with what they actually intend to do. Because they're very fucking different things on the centre left.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, surely with Kamala, we all we have is the rhetoric at this point, right?
Sure, yeah, but I think we can judge certain things as either she's not going to change the position on Gaza, like you know, I would stake my hat on that. Like that's just not going to happen. You know, the idea of either of the two big American parties not supporting the shit out of Israel is absurd.
Well,
even if Bernie took that, I don't think he could have managed that.
No, Bernie has had some good moments and bad moments on Gaza. But what I don't know this is still under the umbrella of rhetoric, but I believe Kamala Harris is not meeting with Netanyahu when he is visiting the States soon. But it's still rhetoric.
Biden moved in that direction, you know, but the funding continues. It's, you know, the thing that matters is that, you know, the international pressure, sure, you know, but not lack of support, like actual pressure on Israel to, you know, to sign a ceasefire or whatever, and the funding. And if they're not going to cut off the funding, then they can, whatever they say is bull. Did you see the thing that Corbyn said a couple of months ago? I think it was in the run-up to the 2017 election when it looked like he had a sniff at, you know, actually winning.
Mm.
And he said that, like, some deep state spook basically took him aside and said, like, look, you might end up as prime minister. The one rule that you can't break is that you support Israel no matter what. Like, that is unconditional. That is part of being prime minister. And, you know, the implication being if you don't, you know, the deep state is going to come and fucking get you. I might be misrepresenting that slightly, but that was the gist of it.
Hmm. That's interesting. I suppose it's, you know, certainly believable, right?
Mm. I mean, it's Corbyn saying it, and he's not known for, you know.
Yeah, he's not. He's not known for, you know, because the thing is for Corbyn as well is like, he, as far as I can tell, like most of the pro-Gaza stuff he says, it's like relatively balanced, like it's relatively sensible. It's not, he doesn't like, I think people, whenever people say, oh, he said this, he's trying to paint him as a Hamas sympathizer, I don't think he is. I think he just genuinely just wants less people to die, like like most people, right?
I think Corbyn, and this was part of Corbyn's problem, I think, in terms of engaging with the electorate, was that what Corbyn, his main policy area that he was interested in was foreign policy and anti-war. He is one of those like old school 70s Labour anti-imperialism, anti-war kind of figures, which is something that doesn't enthuse the public at all. And it was John McDonnell who had to, like, you know, bring him back to, you know, domestic policy, economics, you know, that kind of stuff. I can't remember what my point was, but yeah, I think he is just a fundamentally anti-war person. I think he's almost unquestionable on that. I think that comes from his heart, I very much feel.
Yeah, and I think it also comes from, I think he has a disdain of the rhetoric of war as well, because a lot of the time, like, you know, war is particularly narrativized. You know, you've got the bad guys, you've got the good guys. If you so much as sympathize with the human rights violations we're doing against the bad guys, you are sympathizing.
You're a traitor.
You're a traitor. You're sympathizing with the bad guys. Exactly. And I mean, it's not just us that does that. I think that's just a side effect of war, right? But it's like during, you know, like Good Friday Agreement times and stuff like that, where it's like showing any sort of sympathy to Sinn Féin or even any kind of outreach or negotiating with the IRA was seen as traitorous. But at the end of the day,
let alone even saying the IRA, you know, the Irish Republican position is the morally correct position. That was a massive extreme view, which, you know, to me seems a very reasonable thing to say.
Yeah. So It and I think Corbyn didn't like that. I think he played against that, and I think that he wasn't scared of talking about nuance, and I think that could that typically gets used against you.
God, I would love if we had more nuance.
It'd be great, wouldn't it? Yeah,
I would love it. Just for a politician to go, look, I'm not going to give you a soundbite. This is a very complicated issue.
Yeah.
You know, there's pros and cons, and I can go through the pros and cons, and I can tell you how you know, what I take from that. But, you know, anybody who gives you a black and white picture is lying to you.
Yeah, it's like going into the accountant's office and going, line go up or line go down? One, pick an answer.
Yeah.
You know, I've invested in Beanie Babies, Pokemon cards, and property. Am I richer or am I poorer now?
Which is a much simpler. That has much less nuance to it. You can give a...
Yeah,
You know, and think like because I thought he was great on the EU. You know, we've said before that I can't remember what he said, but like he said, I'm 7/10 in and 3/10 out or whatever.
Yeah,
but you know, the EU was complex, nuanced idea. Anybody who's black and white on that is a fucking idiot. Yeah. Immigration is a very complex issue. I'm not for a second condoning, you know, the racist stuff that comes through it, but it is a complex issue. It intersects with social issues, economic issues, blah blah blah,
and it changes as well. Like there will be, presumably there'll be some years where like it differs, right? Like it always seems to me.
Corbyn, as I would like to take this back to it. You know, he would take almost a humanistic view of it. He'd say that like borders are essentially an abuse, which I would agree with. That's probably where he would want to start, but that's not anywhere near where the public is thinking of this.
Yeah. And again, that requires nuance, and that requires also, I think it requires like a degree of one world thinking. And I think that's one of the problems. It's like everyone, like I think, you know, nationalism generally, I always find very sussy, whether or not it's with Plaid Cymru or like the United States, you know, Stars and Stripes type of thing. It just seems that...
I think internationalism is something that even the left has backed away from. Even the left will like characterize things in terms of national interest and stuff, which they have to, I get it, or they think they have to. But yeah, I do blame to a large extent the media for deleting nuance from politics, essentially.
I think this is where part of my idea for the Fediverse party sort of comes through. It's fundamentally at its core, it is looking at another person and seeing a human before seeing anything else. And because
I've got something to say about that with regard to the shooting, actually, with the not that I saw people overtly celebrating it, but I want to say it is a fucking tragedy that civilian got shot.
Yeah.
Like, it's tragic that man lost his life. And I think, you know, the sort of blue no matter who libs would go like, no, he's at a Trump rally, therefore he is a racist, he is a blah, blah. We don't know any of that. You know, maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But he, essentially, he's a human being who got shot for being at a political event.
And wasn't he a fire chief?
Yeah. Did you see the Trump speech at the convention?
Oh God, I think I did. I didn't know. Oh no, I haven't. That's on my to watch list. But I hear it's awful.
I've not watched the whole thing yet. So the first like 20 or 30 minutes is him just telling his personal story of the assassination, and it's quite moving even. But then they bring on the uniform and helmet of the firefighter dude. And Trump walks up to it because it's arranged like a human figure, you know, the uniform and the hat on top. Yeah. He walks up to it, puts his arm around it, and gives the helmet a little kiss.
I saw that. Yeah,
did you see that? It's very strange. But kind of like, very, I don't know, very human and touching. Like, I don't mind that. But then he sort of took a left turn and went on his usual, you know, polemic rant.
I saw him blow a kiss to Hulk Hogan. He kisses a lot. He's a big kisser. Like,
what the fuck? He does kiss a lot.
It's like very French.
The Hulk Hogan thing was fucking embarrassing.
Oh my word! Yeah, The right wing celebrities always like, they always come out, and it's kind of like, also was it Amber Heard was there? Amber Rose. I'm getting my Ambers mixed up.
It's Amber Rose. Remind me who Amber Rose is.
Hang on a minute. I think she's a socialite. Hang on a minute. Amber Rose. Right. I've got the little thing on the screen. American model, rapper, television personality, first gained attention after starring on a music video for Young Yeezy's 2008 single Put On.
Okay, that's, well, I stopped paying attention to pop culture.
Yeah. she's kind of a I was gonna say, I don't know, like, not necessarily a controversial figure, but a lot of Republicans hate her.
Right.
I think some of that might be racism. I think some of that might be just generally,
a hip-hop style human being.
A hip-hop style human being, absolutely, yeah. So, I don't know. I've got a Daily Mail article up, so, you know, Mail Online. it's the showbiz. But yeah, she spoke at the Republican National Convention as well. And yeah, I'm sure Kid Rock was there.
Oh yeah, no, he's always there, isn't he?
Yeah, that's all I know him from now. Is like Republican stuff.
Yeah,
but they didn't get that country singer guy because he was like
who's that?
So there was this viral like YouTube video of this guy singing a country music song, and it went and he was so real. He was just a man with a guitar singing about the American like, you know, angst at the moment. And and then like people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and everything were like, this guy, he gets it. And then he came back and said, I'm just a simple country guy, but those are the people I'm talking about that are bad. That was an awful accent, and I'm sorry, that's probably very offensive.
Oh, great, I loved it.
I'm not very good at
it. Yeah, no, back to chances of winning.
Mm-hmm.
I've really got no idea. My gut is still that Trump's gonna. I think there's gonna be a swell of enthusiasm for assuming it's Kamala. But I think that will sort of dissipate as they realize it. This is just another dismal centrist, and nobody can really get excited about that. You know, you get the diehard blue, no matter who. If we don't vote for them, then it's going to be the end of democracy and fascism. Like, pretend like 2016 never happened.
What do you make of the Project 2025 stuff?
Oh, that is. I'm always cautious. Like, Trump is not a fascist, right? We just get that. Do we both agree on that?
I don't know. There's an asterisk. There's nuance there.
I would say if Trump is a fascist, then every Republican president and probably every Democrat president for the last whatever is a fascist. Like, he's not different enough from any other Republican president to be pushed into. I mean, without getting into the, you know, if it doesn't quite fulfill these criteria, then it's not fascism, blah blah blah, you know, things. It can be a very bad thing without being fascism.
Well,
and I don't think it has any of the characteristics that are really,
like,
you know, thinking of
fascism. Yeah, I mean, this is a long that's a long conversation, and I don't know useful it would ever be. I think at the point where he enables fascists, he puts fascists on the Supreme Court and all that kind of thing, it's like a lot of fascism seems to orbit around him, and I don't know if the distinction is whether or not the central figure there is a fascist.
I mean, there is a huge distinction between being liked by, you know, the Proud Boys and whatever, like the groups like that. They are fascist and they like Trump, but they're tiny. They are fucking minute. You know, whenever they try and do some sort of fascistic event or rally, you get like 200 people, you know.
But a lot of this stuff,
and always like the counter protest is always much bigger than the.
Yeah, but a lot of Republican stuff is a small amount of people having a disproportionate amount of power. So I think a lot of
I think that's unfair. That's you know, that is representative politics. That's also, you could also make that claim on the Democrat side. They also have, you know, a huge number of normal people who vote for them.
Well, I think the example I would immediately jump to, of course, is reproductive rights. Like, reproductive rights, left or right, in the States, people generally are in favor of it. Like, I think amongst American people, there is still that idealization of personal liberty and libertarianism, and
that just represents, as we've talked about before, the Republicans willing to pull the levers when they're in control of the levers.
Yeah,
the Republicans have never, you know, I agree. Most of the American population wants abortion to be, you know, available to women as needed. But the Republicans have never. They've never lied about the fact that if they can do this, they're going to do this. And they put all the pieces in place in order to do this. And then when they had all the pieces in place, they did it. The Democrats failed to stop them, had the opportunity, you know, as soon as it became clear that the Supreme Court was overstepping its because in terms of, in the Constitution, the Supreme Court is given very little power.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like accrued this power over time, and the Democrats could have corrected that at any point and didn't. Mm-hmm. Ruth Bader Ginsburg did her stupid fucking shit where she'd rather symbolically resign when Hillary was elected rather than, you know, under Obama, and yeah, mm-hmm. we know, you know, then that didn't happen, and she was replaced with a Republican, you know.
Obama literally handed Republicans a free seat because they convinced him that, like, a year before the election was too early. It's like, no, you should let your successor do it. And I think, to be honest, if he knew Trump, and also when he knew Trump was getting involved, was getting looking to win or might have won or anything like that, he could have done it then. Like, he could have just, you know.
Well, the thing is, they didn't. Nobody in the sort of, you know, the liberal sphere believed that it was going to happen, even on election night. I actually recently rewatched the election coverage. Mm-hmm. Of the 2016 American election, and they were stunned. They were shocked. Mm-hmm. Nobody was expecting it, even on the night.
Well, even Trump was surprised, and which is one of the arguments why Project 25 is like more of a threat now than it was back then. Because at the time, no one thought Trump was ever going to get elected. He got elected, and then they didn't have a plan what to do next. Whereas this time,
sorry. Because this is nuanced, and I think the context matters. So to go back to, so first of all, I think what you're saying, what that represents, is that when in power, Republicans are competent, and in terms of getting their agenda, you know, through, mm-hmm. and Democrats are incompetent. I think that's what that represents. I do think if we're going to talk about fascism, mm-hmm. I do think the most characteristic thing, because fascism. People will criticize this as, you know, if we resort to historical definitions, then, you know, modern fascism might take a different form. But if it's so different, then why are we calling it fascism? Why can't it be bad without being labeled fascism? But the thing that really characterized fascism was it's a street movement. Mm-hmm. It's a popular street movement that starts with street violence, with political street violence, and then builds from there. Mm-hmm. Whereas Trump is the opposite of that. He's a figure who the people who would want to do that kind of stuff like. But he, you know, he came in from the top down. He came in through the, you know, the Republican. And in terms of policy, you know, he's not enacted anything remotely fascist. He's been a very run-of-the-mill Republican. And I do think these people that are saying that, you know, if Trump gets, I mean, again, it's very hard to make this argument when we've already had a Trump presidency, but they're still doing it. If Trump is elected, it's the end of democracy or it's fascism. Mm-hmm. I think when it turns out that, you know, say Trump gets elected again, he's just a normal Republican president, mm-hmm. You know, fairly, you know, different presentationally, but in terms of policy, mm-hmm. a normal Republican president, then all you're doing is training people to not be afraid of fascism. If you're saying this is fascism and it happens, mm-hmm. and it's like, well, that was just like, you know, it was the same as when Bush was in power, mm-hmm. then you're just training to, what's the word? That I can't think of.
Right. Oh, yeah. You're
normalizing people.
Yeah.
You're desensitizing people to fascism, and you're lying to them by saying every time somebody like Trump is up that this is going to be the end of democracy.
Yeah. I mean, it almost is a little bit like the boy that cried wolf, but.
Absolutely.
But we know the moral of the story is that one day the wolf comes and no one's ready for it.
Well, no, but exactly. And exactly, because you've said it so many times, you desensitize people, and when it actually happens, nobody gives a shit. That's the exact point, right?
Yeah. But is Project 25 it?
But when fascism comes, it's not going to come through the ballot box, right? It never does. But then we can talk about, okay, if Trump isn't, I mean, feel free to argue that he is, but if Trump isn't fascism, he can still be something very bad.
Yeah, yeah. Like, here's the thing. It's like, if you know, if you laid your set down some parameters by which you would define fascism, and then yeah, Trump wouldn't be a fascism. I guess my being an enabler or a figurehead of fascistic people, I would say, yeah, probably either, if not makes you a fascist, it makes you like, yeah, like it's, but anyway, like you say,
I think Trump makes actual fascists like the Proud Boys or whatever, I think he makes them feel validated and like they have a voice, right? Yeah. I don't think he changes anything in concrete or material terms, but what pushes people to that position is not a Trump presidency, it's endless Democrats who will do fucking nothing for normal people. That's what pushes people to becoming fascist, to joining the Proud Boys.
Yes. Yeah, no, that bit is. So, yeah,
if we want to talk about which is more likely to lead us to fascism, it's not a Trump presidency, because that's almost like a release spell for that impulse. Mm. It's endless fucking dismal neoliberal.
Yeah, no, that bit, like, you know, I'm totally with you on that bit where neoliberalism and that sort of you know, Clinton style Democrat, it just opened the doors for
normal people, and that is not code for white working class. That's working class people of, you know, whatever stripe. Mm. They are continually immiserated and disappointed and let down and disenfranchised by dismal neoliberalism.
Yeah,
and that's what pushes people to fascism.
Yep.
But Project 2025, the stuff that they're, you know, that document's all over the place and kind of disagrees with itself in a lot of places. But if you take the sort of average of what they're suggesting, what they're laying out, that does sound like what is the end point of fascism. That does sound like a very regressive, ethno-nationalist, ultra-conservative, whether that's fascist or not is beyond the point. It sounds like that is a very, very bad, you know, it's essentially bad. The Handmaid's Tale, right, is what they want.
Yeah.
But so, I don't think Trump would enact. He might nod to it rhetorically, he might do the odd bit and bob, but I don't think he's going to enact that as a, you know, as an entire party and say, yeah, now we are this. That will not happen. Most of the Republican machinery does not want that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're probably right. But so do you think, so forget the term fascism. What about authoritarian? Yeah. How authoritarian would you say Trump is?
No more or less than any American. I think America is quite an authoritarian country. It likes to kid itself that it's not. But I think it is through, I mean, and this is arguably fascistic. This is why I say that if Trump is, because the media and the political class are entirely aligned in terms of what they want and what they present without any external force making them do that other than, you know, market mechanism. It, you know, because I mean, the other definition of fascism is that it's a corporate state, and Mussolini, I think the way Mussolini said that was that nothing is outside the state, everything is within the state, and nothing is an enemy to the state, right? And you've kind of already got that. We've got that in most Western democracies, you know, with some little, you know, fringes of criticism. But fundamentally, everybody's in the same boat in terms of ideology.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the ideology represents the interest of billionaires. Billionaires are in control of the politicians, and they're in control of the media. So, you know,
so a system of oligarchs then.
Hmm.
Which is,
so yeah, I think Britain, America, to varying extents, other Western countries, they're very, very corrupt, very authoritarian oligarchies. My voice is gone.
Oh dear. Okay, yeah. I mean,
sorry, I ranted a lot. I very much enjoy hearing your take on that.
Oh God, do you know? I don't know.
Last thing before, to cap it off so that you can respond with your, I think Trump will be, kind of said before, but I think he'll be a run-of-the-mill Republican president. I don't think he's different enough to warrant the panic that Democrats would like to instill, or liberals.
Was there this kind of panic? So what do you make of the panic on the other side? So Hillary Clinton, of course, widely hated by conservatives and, well, a lot of the left, a lot of people. She was not the most likable of people for a number of reasons. But I know that the Republican aligned people, you know, they called her things like Hildebeest, and like they called her demon and all these kind of things. Would you say the scare that the Republicans spread about Hillary was comparable to the scare that Democrats put up?
No. Well, maybe to their people. Maybe it feels the same to their people as this feels to us. We're not, you know, the Democrats people, but we're, you know, if it's two-sided, then we're on that side, right?
Yeah.
Maybe it does feel the same way, but I don't think so. I mean, I thought you were going to ask about Bush. Like, was there this kind of fear-mongering about Bush Jr.?
Well, I seem to remember, and if I'm incorrect, it's that the fear around Bush Jr. was that he was simple. He was a bit dumb.
Yeah, no, I do, but I do think there was this same kind of fear mongering back then for that election. You know, this is he is, you know, beyond the pale. He's far more right wing than, you know, blah. He's going to be the end of blah blah blah. I think that was there. I don't think it was at the same fever pitch that it is now, but I think it was present. I think this is just a thing that the Democrats do to trick people into voting Democrat and getting nothing. If you vote Republicans, things get a little bit worse. If you vote Democrat, things get a little bit worse, a bit slower.
Yeah.
And they have to trick people into voting for that by making the other side seem like the fucking devil.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of one of the problems with the two-party system, really, isn't it? Is that you've got that narrativized division, whereas if you had a multi-party system... Like, during our election, the dynamics of reform really made things interesting. And
it really did, in a way that, again, the media just did not pick up on.
Because reform probably are as annoyed with the Tories as anybody else. They have maybe some different opinions, but then, you know, that's democracy for you, right? And also, a lot of the thing is, people talk about reform like they are to the right of the Conservatives, but I wouldn't necessarily say that they were to the right of the Conservatives.
Well, again, there's nuance. It's a mixed bag. They definitely are in terms of the culture war stuff, or in terms of, well, to the right of the majority of the Tory party. The fringes of the Tory party are, you know, about where reform are. But yeah, on some economic stuff, as we've said, the three-child thing, they want to lift that, and they sort of appeal to a populists. I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. They're like a populist version of the Tory party.
They wanted to bring more stuff into public ownership. That's straight up left wing. But then there were other stuff to counter, but like you say, nuance. To be honest, going back to the American bit, like, I know what you mean, and I sometimes worry, I don't know how to interpret that, if I'm completely honest, whether or not it is scaremongering, whether or not Trump is really as dangerous as all that, because Trump definitely did things in his tenure that were more extreme than other Republicans would do. So, for example, the tax cuts on the billionaire class, they were more than any person vaguely literate in economics would ever do. And
but he also did things like the moratorium on student debt, which Biden came in and cancelled.
Did he? How did that work?
It was because of COVID. Right, because lockdown and what's the word for when people aren't at work?
Furlough.
When people furloughed and they couldn't pay their students, so he just put a moratorium on it, which he never ended, and that could have just carried on forever. You could have just left that moratorium. That was one of the mechanisms, you know, Biden could have used, but no, Biden ended it straight away.
I
think it's all over the place. I don't think you can say really. Even across party lines, I don't think, more people were deported, on the Mexican border, more people were deported under Obama than were under Trump. It's just so all over the place.
But when you say with the immigration thing, I'm always a bit like, surely how many people get deported and whatever is in at least a substantial part down to like circumstantial things outside of America's control, right? Surely there are going to be outside factors that determine how many people are approaching the border. So
certainly, yeah, in terms of how many people are being approaching the border, but I don't think that's the main factor in terms of I mean, okay, this is another example of this whole narrative being bullshit. I remember when it was Biden Trump, right? Because they were saying the same things, it'll be the end of democracy, Trump is a fascist. Mm-hmm. And one of the main things they were pointing to as evidence that Trump was a fascist was the kids in cages at the border, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing that Democrats were holding up as this is fascism, this is why we need to get rid of him. Mm-hmm. And then Biden gets in and that policy continues. the children stayed in the cages. That did not fucking change. So it's clearly bullshit. And I think the reason the vote blew, no matter who, Libs, I think what they get frustrated at is they would say to us, you will agree that Trump is worse than, you know, for example, Biden, right? And would say, yes, no, he is worse than Biden, sure. And therefore, you've got to vote for Biden. Clearly, if one is worse than the other, then you vote for the one that's better. And I don't think they understand that our response is, what gets us into this mess in the first place is keep voting for these lesser of two evils, and these lesser of two evils keep getting worse and worse and worse and worse. This is what foments actual fucking fascism.
Yeah.
This is the problem. Well, this... You've got to offer it something better.
Or up the rhetoric, as, you know, I suppose, is...
Yeah, or just, yeah, fully culture war and politics, actual politics goes out of the fucking window.
Yeah.
Which is kind of where we are. It's all culture war now. Even the stuff that sounds like actual policy, it's really just culture war, because they're not going to fucking do anything.
Yeah, well, culture war's easy. Like, also, you know, with a lot of culture war issues, like, it's easy to make big issues out of ones that you give a lot of airtime to issues to distract from other issues, right? Because at the end of the day, one of the biggest roles that government has in any government is distributing... working out where tax money is spent, or public money is spent.
It's the only thing that actually matters. Yeah. And it's the only thing that's not fucking talked about.
It's when we talk about devolution here in the UK, and we talk about, like, the Welsh Assembly and all that kind of thing, or the Senate, as it's now called. Like, they don't have tax raising powers, so they're barely a administration without tax raising powers. Because if you don't have the ability to tax, then you have very limited ability to spend. You can only spend what is fundamentally...
Even a county council gets to raise some tax for itself, right? In terms of
they get to set the rate of council tax within boundaries, and they also get to do things like build solar farms and things like that. They get to involve themselves in enterprise. And my local county council was a Conservative county council. They built a solar, I think it was a solar farm, and it was bringing in revenue. It was making a profit, and there were plans to continue that, which I think are going underway under the Labour thing. As in, like, I think Labour are continuing them, as far as I can see. So it does seem to be a general, like, cross-party local thing, which is good. So, Welsh Assembly, they are very limited in even the kind of power stations they can build and stuff like that, like devolution. It's a case of, like, you take the power when it's given to you, but you ask for more. You always ask for more. And the thing is,
the problem with the culture war stuff is, because I think it's a thought that just came to me as I was saying it, but I do think everything is culture war now. And the problem with culture war is that it doesn't convince anybody of anything ever. It just further deepens people in the positions they're in. Entrenches is the word I'm looking for. It further entrenches people's positions that they're in. And it just, you know, it increases this kind of bullshit polarization. I think some of the polarization is legitimate. It's a result of young people realizing that if something doesn't fundamentally change, then we have no prospects. Exactly. So, and, you know, based on their own personal experience and education and blah, but they either go to the hard right or the hard left. And I think that is going to sound potentially bad, but I think that is a good thing, because I think that's politics returning to politics. Mm-hmm. What the culture war does is nullifies that as a political force, and just entrenches people in these, you know, symbolic issues that don't actually matter.
Yeah.
That trailed off poorly, but you get what I'm saying, right?
Exactly. But any politician that wants to focus on the economy, to quote Bill Clinton, it all comes down to the economics. That's a paraphrase, not a quote. But, like,
it's the economy, stupid.
But yeah, and the
but
thing
that
is
was correct.
But
not
any,
as he meant it. But no. Yeah.
But any politician that wants to make economic changes, like Corbyn or Sanders, they get nixed. They get, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. If you want to fundamentally, because that is that is challenging the hegemony of capital over Western politics, and that, you know, they will react, and they did react with Bernie, and to a greater extent Corbyn. Mm.
Cool. All right. I've only got about.
But
10...
I think.
Sorry.
Okay. Very quickly. How long do you think we can keep limping on with these dismal fucking centrists every time and the lesser of two evils stuff? But to me, it feels like that is coming. That's has to come to an end. Something's got to give.
Well, it feels like a type of rot, right? Like, it feels like you're driving a car into the ground, type of thing. Like, it's just getting worse and worse and worse. But what then is I suppose a real question. See, this is the thing. The actual breaking of the levy might be Project 25. I don't want to, like, necessarily buy into all the scaremongering, but, like, I don't know. I feel like there's something that there's more than something there. Maybe their scaremongering is just working on me, or maybe the people behind
going back to what we said before, like the way you get fascism is more and more, you know, dismal centrist. And I think the only way out is for the, you know, the supposedly left-wing parties to embrace, you know, at least social democracy, because otherwise there's nowhere for that, you know, that energy I was talking about that wants things to change. The only place it's got to go is the far right, who's actually, you know, an actual active political force.
Yeah. I the thing is, though, like, you look at the American system itself, like, here's the thing, right? I'm a lot more optimistic about British politics at the moment because we actually can U-turn a government in an election. I don't think Americans can really do that. If Kamala wins, maybe she might not get the houses beneath her. There's a very good chance that she might not get the houses beneath her, in which case, it feels like the system at this point in time, whether or not by accident or by design, is stifling any kind of real change, because it's just a game of whoever's the president is working against their own government, whether or not it's blue against red or red against
and
blue.
And again, that's the reason it's more viable here, is because the third parties, right? It's Reform, the Greens, and the Lib Dems that made that you know, that made that happen.
And also how our chambers of government work. Like, we've got basically we've got like a main chamber of government in the House of Commons. We've got a refining sort of chamber in the House of Lords, and then in theory we've got the King to sign it off. That's a much
sometime this is another thing that we're going to need to do a deep dive on. We need to have a deep dive on the US Constitution, because the Constitution, there is a theory of the Constitution that invests a lot of power in the president, but like the mainstream view of the Constitution is it intended to give all power pretty much to Congress. The president was essentially supposed to be a sort of figurehead, you know, and fulfill the role that, you know, our constitutional monarchy fills, of just, you know, rubber stamping the policy. The Supreme Court had very little power. It was supposed to all be invested in Congress, and that would make a lot more sense. That would run a lot better. That it's such a huge problem when you get a president from one party and Congress, or, you know, the Senate and House represent the other party. It's just deadlock, right?
But the thing is, as well, is that, like, if you want to make any kind of meaningful structural change, you need a super, like, either a super majority, or you need Republicans and Democrats to actually come together and actually decide, actually, all right, let's have, which they're not going to do. They're just, there's
no, not, no,
there's no straight up, it's fantasy just to even say it, really. And it, you know, is this where in an alternative timeline where Democrats had balls, they would have actually taken the two seats. They would have got Beto Ginsburg's seat. They would have got the missing seat that Obama handed over. They would have got the Supreme Court over, and then done the same overreaching that Republicans have done to actually, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, the problem is that the Democrats play by, you know, in inverted commas, the rules, you know, the gentlemanly, you know, we're supposed to behave this way kind of stuff. And the Republicans don't. But I mean, what the Democrats now, what the sort of liberals are calling for is expanding the Supreme Court, you know, so that a Democrat president can stick a bunch of Democrat leaning judges in there. But what do they think is going to happen the next time Republicans in charge? They're just going to expand it further and expand that. Just that does not solve the problem. You've got to disempower the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was never intended to fucking legislate. That's the job. That's the job of Congress. The Supreme Court wasn't supposed to legislate. The president wasn't supposed to legislate. Congress is. Supreme Court is just supposed to be a highest form of court, like the House of Lords used to be here, and then we replaced it with Supreme Court, where they just ultimately have decide on legal cases. That wasn't supposed to be a source of expanding it isn't good enough. You need to either abolish, ideally, or just disempower the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but then again, any of those changes requires more.
Yeah,
yeah.
And because the stuff they're doing now isn't laid out in the Constitution, so it wouldn't take an amendment. It would just take a majority in Congress, I think, to change. I think I might be wrong about that.
But that's sort of where I think it sort of is leading, is that I think the American system is kind of in a boot loop. Is that what they call it when the system just keeps rebooting?
In what, sorry?
Like a boot loop. What's it
a
when
boot a loop. Yeah, that's apt. Yeah.
Like it's like, oh, grub's crapped out and now it's just going around and around and around.
Yep.
Something like that. Yeah. It's and that's kind of how it feels. Like, you know, I think in the UK we you know, I think we'll probably sort of regain some kind of normalcy, and I think the Conservatives will start regrouping, and I think, you know. But I think with the States, that rot has set in, and I think
it's that rot. There is a change coming down the line, you know, as the old people die off and the young people come through. They do want, you know, I think we talked about it last time, that poll in France of, you know, young people and their voting intention, and the same over here. Mm. And it's they're hard left and hard right, and some in the middle, of course, but they're far more of them are hard left and hard right than they are of, you know, even our generation.
Yeah,
so there's a change coming down the line, and parties aren't ready for it. Something, you know, things are gonna go to shit.
But also, I think one thing as well, and this is a little bit more fantasy politics, is that I think there is actually some legitimacy in the idea of breaking down the United States into a number of countries.
We need an entire episode for that one, yeah. Or at least more time than you've got right now. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, very quickly, the problem with that is certain states have all the money, so you'd have an incredibly wealthy California and an incredibly impoverished, you know, whatever region. You know, the Midwest would be okay because farms, but
Texas, where they don't do taxes.
Yeah.
But then you've basically got California funding Texas in the same way that London funds the rest of the UK. Like that, the centralization in some ways is the problem.
Again, that's complicated though, because the London funds the UK by sucking up all of the talent and money and resources from the rest of, you know, it's almost like a mini imperialism, a mini colonialism.
You could say that about California.
I don't think that's quite as true of America, because it's not quite so centralized. You have multiple poles of economic, cultural, so on, and political power. Not political so much, but you have different poles of power. Like New York is economically huge. California is economically huge. Texas, I think, is doing very well economically.
What about Vegas?
I mean, Las Vegas, I'm sure, makes a ton of money, obviously, yeah. Yeah, but it's... it's not as straightforward as one pole soaking up all of the resources over there. You could separate California from the Midwest, but then, you know, where you go buy your food from, you know, the Midwest just hikes up grain prices. It's just that would not work for any of them, really.
Yeah, maybe. But cool. All right, are we good to wrap it up there? Cool. Anyway, to summarise, I think Kamala stands a better chance, but at the moment I would still put it in Trump's favour, but I think things could change. I think they're in a better position now than they were.
A very brief congratulations to, what were they called, CrowdStrike. Successfully hacking 9 million Windows computers. Well done.
Well done. Bravo. Yeah.
The biggest hacking group in the world.
Yeah, well done. All right. Cool. All right, we wrap it up there.
Yep.
All right. Toodaloo, everyone.